invitation this time that helped us start this one. I'll just mention a few of his books, which you probably know already. The New American Nation, New Nationalism and the Fourth American Revolution, Up from Conservatism, Why the Right is Wrong for America, and Made in Texas, George W. Bush and the Southern Takeover of American Politics. I hadn't realized that this Renaissance man had also published several volumes of fiction and poetry, including The Alamo, which the Los Angeles Times named as one of the best books of the year, and a prize-winning children's book, Blue Bonnet Girl. So thanks very much, Michael.
Thank you. I'm pleased to be back at this seminar. I think I'll begin with a reference to a New Yorker cartoon that Professor Appleby may know. I think it's back in the 50s or 60s. Shows a medieval or early modern peasant leaving the kissing his wife goodbye and saying, "I'm off to fight the 30 Years' War." And of course, the joke is, until it's over, you don't know whether it's the 30 Years' War, the 100 Years' War, the 7 Years' War. So even though my charge is to talk about Obama's first year, I want to begin with a broad camera angle. I think in the last year or so since the crash in the fall of 2008, we now know we're in a new period. In the previous period, it ended. And where did the previous period begin? 1973, mentioned by Dr. Appleby as a possibility. You could say 1980. But clearly, there's now a terminus to that period, since we're not going to go back to something like it. We may go back to something worse, or go forward to something worse. And just as the New Deal era lasts, either from the crash of 1929 or FDR's election in 1932, up until 68 or 76 or 73 or 80, that we now know that we don't have a name for this period that followed the New Deal, but we can see it had a beginning, a middle, and an end. The debate about this period has to do with, let me say by starting with 1980. That's when you clearly get into a bubble economy. It didn't just start in the 1990s. You have this period of slow economic growth after 1973. It picks up in the latter part of the 1990s. And then people declare that, well, the whole 1973 to 1995 was an aberration, and now we're back on this steady upward track. Turns out the uptick seems to have been an aberration within this larger arc from 1980 to 2008. I won't go into the debate about what the underlying causes of this were, except to enumerate the different theories. One theory is that it took place entirely at the level of regulation, that you had a successful financial regulatory system set in place during the 1930s and then dismantled by the end of the century. Other theories look at the real economy, and particularly the real physical productive economy underlying this financial bubble sort of economy. Robert Brenner has written very illuminating things about this, and a number of other people have. There are Marxists who see a gradual slowing of the entire system. There are neo-Schumpeterians, economists who follow the economist Joseph Schumpeter, who argue that this has been a transition between one wave of technological innovation associated with automobiles and electricity gradually playing out, and a new wave of information technology. So I won't get into that. Instead, what I want to do is simply say that whatever the causes, we now know what happened, at least from 80 to 2008. Because economic growth was so slow, for whatever underlying reasons, various countries tried various desperate policy gambits, and not just here, but the other major industrial nations. Whether it was crushing labor, goosing the economy with low interest rates. The Japanese, the Germans, and the Chinese, the other three biggest economies in the world, pushed ahead relentlessly with a kind of mercantilist, export-oriented policy, which made a great deal of sense for Germany and Japan after World War II, and then for China in its developmental phase. But even after it had become obsolete, and they should have shifted to a more domestic, demand-driven, service sector-based economy, they continued pumping manufactured goods through these export machines into the economy, thereby lowering profits for everybody else. What that meant was that the search for high rates of return went from the manufacturing sector, where partly because of global overcapacity, as many people argue, profitability had collapsed, into essentially gambling. And that's what asset inflation is. You know, you're gambling on tech stocks. You're gambling on housing prices. There was a brief period of gambling before the crash in oil and other commodities, and that is likely to return in the next couple of years. There's all this money looking for rates of return higher than you can get from the real economy. So that's the setting what I think of this as yet nameless period. Let's call it the bubble era of the last 30, 40 years or so. We get a distinct kind of liberalism or progressivism and a distinct kind of conservatism in this era, which is quite distinct from the New Deal Democrats and from the Eisenhower Republicans, just as they were distinct from their predecessors in the early 20th and 19th centuries. We have bubble conservatism. And this is, you know, Reagan conservatism, Bush conservatism. And it develops its own ideology, its own peculiar kinds of political habits that really don't have much precedent with any other country. The basic political approach was made possible only in a period of asset inflation. And that was the strategy of not cutting spending. You talk about it, you denounce big government, but you don't actually cut spending, including social insurance and other forms of middle-class welfare, to say nothing of corporate welfare and military spending. So you combine high levels of spending with permanent tax cuts creating deficits. And this formula makes no sense economically. Even the supply-siders, like Bruce Bartlett, who was a Treasury official under Ronald Reagan, has recently scandalized his conservative colleagues by pointing out that the intelligence supply-siders, anyway, never claimed that a dollar in tax cuts automatically created a dollar in revenue growth. As a political formula, this has been the formula of the post-Reagan Republicans, in the same way the bloody shirt was the formula of the post-Civil War Republicans. Repeated votes on Social Security and a minimum wage became the political formula of the New Deal Democrats. So not only do you have this policy of tax cuts at all costs in terms of the deficit, but you get this, what now in 2010 seems like a very remote, quaint kind of ideology about universal capitalism. And the ownership society. About 10 years ago, I remember reading World Bank reports on how to structure a pension system. And there was universal consensus, and these are global authorities, and this is Europe and East Asia and the United States, that because public pension systems could not be trusted to be solvent, every country should restructure its pension system to put more money in the more secure stock market. This was the universal consensus of the time. We had the idea that we are now a nation of investors, which was always misleading because that simply meant that a majority of people, a slight majority, like 50-60% by the beginning of this century, had pension funds invested in the stock market. But nevertheless, there was this fantasy that everyone is a day trader now in this free agent nation. So that was bubble conservatism. We saw a similar deformation or evolution of progressivism during the bubble era, and let's call this bubble progressivism, sometimes known as neoliberalism. And because the Democrats were the minority party, what Samuel Lubell would have called the moon party to the Republican sun party during this period, the Democrats from after LBJ tended to accommodate the dominant worldview of the ascendant of Reagan and post-Reagan conservatives, and in the same way Grover Cleveland kind of fit into the late 19th century, a period of Republican hegemony. And this neoliberalism was designed to incorporate a lot of the assumptions of bubble conservatism about the market and about social insurance and privatization, while retaining its own distinct claim to being on the left. Which came, and the synthesis of this is what I think of as the teeny weeny tax credit. Because beginning in the Clinton years and continuing, as I'll get to in a moment, in the Obama years, whereas the New Deal Democrats were characterized by a small number of universal solidaristic social programs, Social Security and Medicare. This is what you think of. You think of FDR and LBJ. The New Democrats, Bill Clinton being a New Democrat president, arguably Barack Obama as well, they will pull out of their pockets. It's kind of like family photos that all come tumbling down out of the wallet. You know, a list of 20 or 30 tax credits, all of which are quite small, and are also means tested to make them more effective, according to economists. But also, they're focused on the very poorest Americans. But they're not universal programs that embrace everybody. And as I'll get to in a minute, the healthcare program actually fits this kind of approach. So you get this kind of consensus shared by the bubble left and the bubble right. That in the words, I'm paraphrasing Larry Summers, that the market usually gets things right, that every 100 years or so there's a perfect storm. And then you can bring in Keynes out of the attic in which he's been locked up for a couple of years, and then he has to be locked up again, and we're back to the self-harmonizing markets. I'm stressing that this is a consensus shared by most Democrats in Washington as well as most Republicans. Where the justification of government is market imperfections. Most mainstream Democratic economists accept this as much as moderate conservative Republican economists. That is, the market is the norm. So when there's a market failure, that's when you can actually have public governments, which are interventions to correct the market failure. So this brings us up to Barack Obama. Who is he? My answer is he is the third New Democratic president. That is, the Democratic Party of today bears very little resemblance to the party that existed between FDR and LBJ, either in philosophy or certainly in demographic makeup. The Roosevelt to Johnson party was largely like the old Jacksonian Democrats, white Southerners and Northern Catholics, with a few progressives thrown in. If you look at the map of the Democratic Party today, it's the 19th and early 20th century Republican Party. It's New England, the Midwest, the parts of the West Coast that were settled by New Englanders in the 19th century. I asked the late Senator Daniel Patrick Moynihan one time what the Democrats today celebrate on Jefferson Jackson Day. They really should be celebrating Henry Clay and Abraham Lincoln Day if you look at the areas that vote for Democrats and vice versa. The Republicans, their core now are the states of the former Confederacy. So arguably we had a realignment in the 1970s and 1980s. And it sort of simplifies it as a joke. I would say that we have two parties now, the Rockefeller Republicans and the Dixiecrats. And the Rooseveltians are nowhere to be seen, except as kind of a dying wing of what is now essentially the Rockefeller Republican Party. And so these Rockefeller Republicans were New Democrats, and as was pointed out to me earlier, Eisenhower might have been a bit too left-wing for today's New Democrats with the budget-busting, tax-raising interstate highway system and his refusal to speculate about partly privatizing Social Security. So enter Barack Obama. As I say, after Carter and Clinton, he is the third in a series of presidents in what objectively is a new party that began in the 1970s and 1980s. Its base, its financial base, is Wall Street and Hollywood. Its demographic base is Greater New England, the old Lincoln Republican territory. And its approach to economic policy is this kind of neoliberalism that evolved in what I'm calling the bubble years. Let's look at the president's new foundation. There were three elements to this new foundation. Sometimes now they say financial reform, but originally it was healthcare, the environment, and education. Of these three elements of President Obama's new foundation, education has the closest resemblance to an old-fashioned New Deal Democrat type program. Essentially, their proposal, after the revelation of the sheer corruption of government-subsidized private lending to college students, is to cut it out and have direct government loans. So this is kind of an old-fashioned government status liberal program. If you look at the healthcare proposal and the environmental proposal, these are classic 80s, 90s, early 2000s neoliberalism, where instead of doing something directly, as the New Dealers would have done it, you do it through a very complicated kind of Rube Goldberg system of incentives to encourage private actors, hopefully, if they can make a profit, to carry out a public purpose. So, for example, the cap and trade scheme is based on the premise that if you raise prices of electricity coming from fossil fuel sources sufficiently, then investors on Wall Street will have a sufficient incentive to get rich by maybe investing in startup companies, which maybe on their own will come up with an electric battery or economical solar and wind power installations or something like that. This is, as I say, it's a Rube Goldberg scheme, and the whole premise is that you can't do something directly. You can't simply, by use of regulation, for example, mandate fuel efficiency. That's old Democrat. That's old Rooseveltian thinking, right? No, you know, we're new Democrats. We're market-oriented, so we have to give incentives instead of simply orders. You can't spend $30 billion a year or $100 billion on direct energy R&D from government laboratories. You know, if you use this approach under the Roosevelt administration to create to invent atomic power, then the U.S. would have levied a tax on kerosene in order to encourage Andrew Mellon and his friends to find some startups, you know, which would hire some physicists, you know, to, you know, experiment with nuclear power, and then you would give them, you know, tax breaks if they commercialized it. So there are direct ways of dealing with global warming, which can be done entirely through regulation and direct effort, be it R&D, be it a carbon tax, but that is not the route that this president and his administration and Congress have chosen, partly because the New Democrats have run against that kind of direct government public investment and direct regulation. I was at a dinner with a member of the president's economic council, who shall remain unnamed, and this question came up, and he said, as in general, we do not believe in regulation. We believe in incentives and transparency. So there it is from the source. This is a worldview, and it's not, and it's very deeply rooted in the policymakers. Healthcare, again, a perfect example. The Rooseveltian approach was to incrementally expand single payer over time, if possible. Begin with Medicare, then you have SCHIP. You fight for lowering the Medicare age to 55. This is a completely different approach. And you can make a case that it might have made things better. It would have been the first federal regulation of insurers, which would be a good thing, and there are various good pieces of the legislation. But let's face it, the DNA of the healthcare reform has nothing whatsoever to do with the paternity of Franklin Roosevelt and Lyndon Johnson. This is a completely different approach. So right now, single-payer accounts for roughly half of our medical economy, right? It's not all that unrealistic to think that by salami tactics over decades, you could get to 60 or 70%, at which point there would be a fairly rapid transition because you would have to go one way or the other. So at some point, the salami tactics might provoke the universalization of single-payer Medicare and Medicaid, with the private sector, you know, playing a supplementary role, the way it does in many countries, with single-payer systems. So in the president's proposal, and just in President Clinton's proposal, you would permanently lock in two completely different incompatible systems in your medical sector. There would be a single-payer system for everyone over 65, and then there would be this completely different system, which is most closely resembles the Swiss system of individual mandates, with the exception that the Swiss system, which, by the way, is the most expensive in Europe, is based on nonprofit insurers. But here, the insurers would have to be guaranteed a profit. So why are they doing this? It's not simply greed and corruption, though that plays, you know, the lobbying plays a part. It's this neoliberal ideology that grew up in the bubble years. You can't do anything directly. That's too statist. What you have to do is subsidize private for-profit corporations to do what the government would do in other countries, or in fact what the government might have done in the 50s and 60s and up to the 70s. And then you call that market friendly. In fact, it has nothing to do with markets, because the premise of the neoliberal approach to economics is that the private sector will not carry out these public purposes unless they are bribed into doing so by the taxpayers. It's actually a system of contractors of the kind that we've seen in foreign policy, but it applied to every area of domestic policy. My view of the president is that, unsurprisingly, since all of the evidence before the election was that he identified with the new Democrat wing of the party, that, you know, he would come out with this approach. You would rely on private entities with that have to make a profit to carry out public purposes. Does that mean I've given up on him? No. If you look at FDR in the first part of his presidency, he was a progressive. His mind was full of all of these early 20th century ideas about national planning and about Social Security was too radical for him at that point. He was big into planning and into what was called associationalism, which was the purpose of the NIRA, of cartels of employers and the unions working together to keep up prices. So what we think of as Roosevelt liberalism actually only emerged over time in the second and the third New Deal. Abraham Lincoln, in the first year of his presidency, was not a Lincoln Republican, as that was known after the Civil War. He was a Henry Clay Whig. That's what he told people. I'm an old-fashioned Henry Clay Whig. He was hoping that the South would negotiate some kind of deal where slavery would be guaranteed up until 1900 or so, and the federal government would pay for the gradual, peaceful manumission of the slaves. So it may very well be the case that when this president and the Democratic Party realize they have to rethink this 30-year-old neoliberal approach to things, that they will indeed rise to the occasion. And I just would conclude by saying of President Obama that I hope it's true that what Winston Churchill said of the United States, he said, the Americans can be counted upon to do the right thing when they have exhausted the alternatives.
Thank you very much. Our next presenter is...